We've got a lot of ground to cover this morning. You guys are going to take a 3,000-year-old trip in approximately an hour. Just imagine how fast the car is going to go. We are going to talk about God's ancient gospel track, the Passover Seder. You're going to learn a little of what Jewish people do today. You're going to learn a lot about what happened in that upper room, and you're going to see how it connects to your faith. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. I will help you understand which is which, what happened in the upper room, what Jewish people do today, and definitely what happens as far as our faith. One thing that did not happen, well, let me start by pointing out what this is. This is called a Haggadah. Now, in ancient times, Jewish people all lived in about the same geographic area until what was called the diaspora, or diaspora. So everyone knew, like knowing the hymns without the notes being put in. But when Jews were scattered, they had to have some way of keeping track of the customs that God had given them through his law. And so one of the things you had to do is you had to put it in writing. So this is a Haggadah. It comes from the Hebrew word or verb to tell, because this is a retelling of the Exodus. The night itself, when this is done, is called a Seder, which means order, because unlike every other meal in a Jewish home, this meal is specifically and very carefully ordered to retell the story. So it's an ordered meal. So it's called a Seder, which means order. Now, something that did not happen in the upper room was for a woman to light the candles. Normally, this is the most family-centered of all the Jewish holidays. It's actually done in the home, not in the synagogue. But the funny thing was, Jesus was not celebrating that with his natural family. He was investing in the 12 men that were going to carry his message, and for that night, they were his family. It is traditional in the Jewish home to have different roles for men and women and children. And so long ago, the rabbi said the woman lights the holiday lights because the women in Moses' generation were more righteous than the men. I always jokingly say the rabbi's wife told him so. Good. Feel free to laugh because there's going to be Jewish humor in here. Can't help it. I come by it ethnically. So my wife is going to light the candles.
Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sent your Son, Yeshua, the Messiah, to be the light of the world and our Paschal Lamb, that through him we might live.
That's not the traditional blessing. You will hear some Hebrew, but I'm gonna keep time in mind. That's not the traditional blessing in a Jewish home. If it were, you wouldn't need Jewish missionaries. Less than 1% of the Jewish people believe in Jesus. So we are still considered an unreached people group. We are also considered a gospel-resistant people group. Go share on the streets of Brooklyn, New York in some places, and you will learn what resistance means. There are reasons for that that you will come to understand as the evening goes on, but understand that I always tell people that Jewish missions is not easy work. Normally, in a Jewish home, this also didn't happen with the disciples. Remember, Jesus is not celebrating this the way it would normally occur. Already, some things are different from the beginning of that night as far as the setting. But Jewish families actually have Jewish children. And so it is traditional for the father to act as the priest head of his household and bless his children. And this is an absolutely wonderful thing. Now, I make application throughout this entire thing. Fathers, give your kids a sense of destiny. You do that by instilling in them some sense of who they are in Messiah and what they are able to accomplish for him. So we were very deliberate in naming our children. We did certain things to instill a sense of who they were and how it connected to God. The way Jewish people have always done it is they talk about the matriarchs and patriarchs of Israel. You're part of something bigger than you. So for the boys, it's traditional to say, may the Lord make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. This blessing adds, like Abraham, the father of all who believe, because he is the father of all who believe. Peter, Andrew, and John, and the other disciples who followed Yeshua, because they are following in the tradition of the faith of Abraham by believing in the one that was sent. For the girls, there are the matriarchs of Israel. May the Lord make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. But you know, there are also women who followed Jesus. And so they are worthy of mentioning because they are acting the way Sarah acted. And so we mention Susanna and Joanna. Now, have you heard there's an app for everything? There's an app for the Aaronic benediction. I keep a Hebrew and Greek Bible on my phone. I want to tell you something. When the Aaronic benediction is recited, the hands are put like thus. The reason I tell you this is if any of you watch a real old show that was around when I was young called Star Trek, that's right. Do you know where Leonard Nimoy got that? He was the cantor in his synagogue. He was from an Orthodox Jewish family. This is the proper priestly positioning of the hands. So he took that, and now you know where Jewish custom and science fiction meet. Okay? So it's not the Vulcans, it's the Jews. This makes the letter Shin. Remember what God said to Abram. I am El Shaddai. Walk before me and be complete or perfect. And so the Shin reminds the Jewish people of the name of God that God came to Abraham with and told him to walk before him in truth and covenant loyalty. Now let's see if my app is very readable in this light. Yivarechacha Adonoi meyishmarecha, Ya'ir Adonoi panav elecha uvichunecha, Yatsam Adonoi panav elecha v'yitsem lecha shalom. The Lord make his face to shine up. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you, be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you wholeness. That's what the word shalom really entails. There are four cups here. Now, normally in Jesus' day, you had someone to refill the cups. You had time. You weren't going anywhere. At least not for a little while. And so these would be refilled. What we like to do is have all the cups up at once because I want to create a visual for you. This is about looking at the big love story and seeing how it connects. These four cups are connected to four promises. Now, what you need to understand is the bread and cup are going to come out of one of these cups and something else. And Yeshua, that's Hebrew for Jesus, Jesus is going to be very particular as to which cup out of the four he chooses for the bread and cup. And you're going to see why that cup and where that fit in. So you're going to see the nexus point between what he did and why he did it in the context of what was going on. The four promises are given in Exodus, right around the Exodus, when God makes some promises to Israel. And God speaks to Moses, and he gives these particular promises. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, Exodus 6:6, I will bring you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I will rescue, or in Hebrew you can use the word deliver you from their bondage. I will redeem you. And I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Four promises, four cups. The whole purpose of the Seder is to use sight and smell and touch to bring home spiritual truth. And how do you teach a desert people truth? With concretes that they can see, you teach what is unseen. And so all of these things are designed, and so each of those cups, as it's refilled, has a name and is connected with a promise. And that promise will echo in the heads of the participant as the cup is taken. That is the idea, to create connections. So, the first cup. Now, I'm going in Hebrew order. I like to tell people, if you want to learn something about English, about language, which way do we read English? You can participate, right? Good. All European languages read that way. Which way do you read Semitic or Mideastern languages? The other way. Oriental languages were originally written up and down. So you can know where a language sort of came from by the way it's written or read. A little bit of linguistics thrown in there. So we're going to follow the Hebrew order. You need to know each cup. Okay? This is called the cup of sanctification. Now the promise was, I will bring you out. So now you're saying, what in the world does that have to do with sanctification? The Hebrew word for holy is kadosh. It means to be separate. The Greek word hagias has the same exact meaning. So the concept behind holiness is distinction or separateness. In terms of holiness, in terms of moral holiness, it's separation from sin. And so this is the cup because God never intended to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt to give them an all-expense-paid vacation. He separated them for his service that they might be separate, kadosh, from the pagan-worshipping nations around them. You do need to hear a little Hebrew. The traditional, and the reason I do this is Jesus took the cup and he blessed it, but no one ever knows what he said. You will today. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam bo rei pri hagafen. Blessed are you, O Lord, King of the universe, who has given us the fruit of the vine. That's what grapes are. They're the fruit of the vine. And so this cup of sanctification would then be drank. I'm not going to do that because I've got a mic right here. And I don't know what I would do to the sound crew if it shorted and sparked, and we're not going to go that route. Okay? But I'm putting this cup aside. You need to know this cup no longer exists. The next time this cup's filled, it's the second cup. It's not the first cup again. So our cup countdown has already started at the very beginning. So be paying attention to the cups because they're going to be very significant. The Seder plate. I love Passover. It's a beautiful, wonderful story with props. And my wife did a great job, along with my daughter, Devorah, in setting up the props, along with some help from you guys. You need to understand the props. Before I start manipulating the players in the story, the props in the play, I need to introduce them to you. Let me start by introducing the props I don't eat. I will not be gnawing on this no matter how hungry I may get. This is the shank bone of a lamb. You could see where the patella, the knee, would come in. Okay? You're going to see some differences in tradition between Jews who are part of the diaspora in northeastern Europe. They're called Ashkenazi Jews, and then the Jews in the diaspora that stayed near the Middle East because of what was available to them. You cannot find sheep in Siberia in March unless they've been dry frozen. So Eastern European Jews, they have a rabbinical reason. There's a practical reason for not using sheep. They aren't there. So sometimes a chicken bone will be used. You can get chicken just about anywhere. And everything tastes like chicken anyway. So who cares? You don't eat this. It's on the Seder plate. What's important for you to understand is this is a symbol of the sacrificial system. Do you know what Jewish people don't have anymore? The sacrificial system. I like to say, and I'm finishing my doctorate in apologetics. Apologetics is real simple. No blood, no forgiveness. Okay? This is a simple principle. Judaism is like a beautiful car with no engine. Much of the truth, some of the truth, and a lot of the beauty's been preserved, but it can't get you anywhere because this bone has no blood and there's no temple. So rabbinical Judaism can't get you there. The other thing I'm not going to eat is betza. Betza is a hard-boiled egg. The reason that is often given in old Jewish writings for the hard-boiled egg is that during the Jewish holidays, there would be a double offering. So offering one, the Paschal lamb, offering two, the additional offering for the holidays. But interestingly enough, Beitzah doesn't appear on the Seder plate until after the Babylonian captivity. And then all of a sudden, Beitzah appears on the plate. The Babylonians regarded the egg as a symbol of resurrection. They kept seeing chickens popped out. They thought the chicken they killed was the chicken that came out of the egg. See, it came back. And so they considered this a symbol of resurrection. What's interesting is right around this time of year, I call this the Babylonian connection. The egg's on the Seder plate, and the egg's connected with Easter because of the resurrection connection. Few other things we are going to eat. I won't be manipulating them too much. You have a paste called charoset. Eastern European Jews had available walnuts, apples. They had grapes available, and cinnamon through the spice trade route. And so Eastern European charoset is made this way. Mid-Eastern or Sephardic charoset includes dates and figs, which you also don't find in Siberia in the winter. So it's made a little differently. This is horseradish. I will be manipulating those things a little later, but you need to be aware of horseradish. Endive can be used. Eastern European Jews like their horseradish. And we'll talk more about that. This is the one I'm going to use now. This is karpas. This is the green leafy vegetable. You can use lettuce. I don't like to use lettuce. I want everything to point to spiritual truth on the Seder plate, which it can and should. And so this looks like hyssop. Now, many of you might like the Psalms. The Psalms are absolutely beautiful for praying back to God. You out of luck for a prayer? Open to the Psalms, and you will find things. David says, wash me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Does this look like a bar of soap to you? Okay? What in the world is he discussing? Hyssop was used in the temple, and it was connected with the sacrificial system and purification from sin. Wash me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Provide for me atonement, God, and I will be atoned for, is what David is saying. This is also what they used to put the blood on the doorposts. They were to take hyssop and place it on the doorposts. Now, we can't just have hyssop. We have to have something more. We're going to be dipping it, or I'm going to be dipping it in salt water. If you like parsley, which is what this is, it looks like hyssop, you won't after you dip it in salt water. Okay? Not every item on the Seder plate is tasty. Some are really good. Some are to remind you, but they aren't quite as tasty as others. Why? Salt water tastes like tears. I like to point out Exodus 12:22, and the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. God does know your pain. Unlike former presidents and politicians, God really does know your pain, and he cares about the hurts of his people in a fallen world. So you would dip the hyssop in the salt water, and you would take a bite of that, take a little bite. And if the salt water is really good, what you taste are the taste of tears. Two washings occur in the Passover Seder. Read John 13 and you have one of them. The hardest thing in the world is to coordinate John with the other Gospels. John isn't written to unbelievers. John says, I write these things to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know you have eternal life. He's writing around 90 AD to the believing community. Matthew is reinforcing believers, but he's also talking to unsaved Jewish countrymen and structures his gospel differently. Two washings. Why washings? How do you teach people about moral uncleanness? Remember what I said. You teach the unseen with the seen. With washing. That's why you find all those regulations in Leviticus about washing, because it was designed to be lessons in remembering to be holy for a people that he wanted to get truth into, that he was going to personally rule as king. And he was going to dwell among them, so they had to be what he wanted them to be. And so there are two washings. This first washing occurs because whenever you're going to touch an object of great importance in the story, you do not touch it with defiled hands. You do not defile that which is a symbol of proper separation unto God. This is probably the place where Jesus washes the disciples' feet. I love to go through this in John because this is so radically different that Peter says something like, "You will never wash my feet." Could you imagine talking to God in the flesh and telling him he will never do something? Okay. Actually, some translations say, "No, Lord," and I always joke, there is the greatest ridiculous statement in the world. If he's your Lord, you have no right to say no, and if you're saying no, is he really your Lord? And so Peter says that, and Jesus says, "You have no koinonia, fellowship with me, if I do not wash your feet." And then Peter says, "Good, I'd like a complete bath. Give me the works." And Jesus says, "You don't need that. All of you are clean except one." And we're going to see, he doesn't even stick around for the meal. So, I'm not going to go ahead and do that, but normally it's not a complete washing. You don't get out soap and because you're going to be touching items you're going to eat, but you would just pour water over your hands three times. And my grandfather would do that at our Seder when he was still alive. Now, what's he going to touch? Pay close attention. This is one of the all-time coolest things that I grew up with and never understood the significance of. And I'm going to mention that again because it so bears repeating. Now, Jesus probably did not have anything this ornate. This is from Israel, brought in the Second Holy Land, Brooklyn. Okay? Probably what he had was a piece of homespun cloth that was enfolded in such a way to create three compartments. It can be done. Anyone out there into origami? We can talk about it later. Okay? What's important about this bag is it's one bag with three compartments. Each compartment has a matzah. Understand something. One of the biggest stumbling blocks for the Jewish person to the gospel is the Trinity. Now you say, what is the problem? Is there plenty of evidence for the triunity of God? Yeah, talk to me. I can demonstrate it from the old. Okay, there is perfect evidence for it. But understand something. God didn't fully reveal his unique nature to the children of Israel because they were surrounded by pagan nations. And if he started teaching them three, they might have gone from three to three deities. And so he taught them what they could bear at the time given the situation they were in. That's why we believe in progressive revelation. And so we have a bag. But here's what's so cool. Now I have the one that is three. Okay? Now in Yachatz, I take out the middle. This gets so neat. I take out the second of the one that is three. This is bruised and it is pierced. By rabbinical law, it is not matzah. For Passover, it is not if it is not bruised and pierced. Now, you want the physical reason Jews do this? This will not rise. Ever. It's dead bread. Okay, whatever makes bread rise, we fried it. Bruised because it was cooked at a high temperature quickly. We mechanically pierced it so it won't rise. So it's bruised and pierced and as unleavened as you can ever get. You can keep this on your shelf. I joke about the Dead Sea matzah. This does not spoil unless you add water to it and do things to it. But if you leave this in the box, like 5 years from now, I could pull out matzah. Okay. This is really not going to do much. Okay? I've taken the second of the three that is one, which is bruised and pierced, and now it is broken. Now, we don't waste anything, but first, I'm going to go ahead and take the second of the three that is one, which is bruised and pierced, and I'm going to wrap it in linen, and I'm going to bury it. I love it when I see the lights go on. I just do. The other piece is going to be used real quickly for an invitation, and I'm going to do that invitation because I think it's a worthwhile invitation for you to hear. Let all who are in, this is the bread of affliction. Sorry, this is the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate. Let all who are in need come and celebrate the Passover. Why do I do that? I keep talking to believers all the time, and they say, I'm not sure how to share the gospel. I don't know what to do. What are the right words? And I say to them, no, this is not a problem. You're inviting them to a love feast. You're inviting them to God's Passover. In fact, as we go through this, you're going to see that there's a real easy gospel track that you can always use. And so think about it that way. You already have your story. It's a pre-written gospel tract designed by God Almighty for particular people that he will touch with it. Don't ever underestimate the power of your testimony. And you have a purpose, inviting people. And you're even going to have a neat three-point gospel tract by the time this is done. Now for the four questions. Probably was not done quite the same way that night. Usually it's the youngest child that asks the questions. The questions are before we get to the story. Who tells a story without being asked something? It's so very Jewish. And so you end up asking the questions, and you know what's so funny about this? The four questions are never answered directly. Because this is to make the children pay attention as they're seeking the answers in the story. Even though they don't directly get the answers, they got the story, which is the real purpose. I'm going to do them in Hebrew and then English. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot, shebechal halilot anu ochlincha meitzu matzah. Halayla hazeh, halayla hazeh, kulo matzah. Why is this night different from all other nights? On all other nights, we may eat either chametz, that's leavened bread, or unleavened bread, that's matzah. But on this night, we eat only matzah. From the first Seder night through Passover, nothing made with leavened bread will be eaten. That's flour, water, and 17 minutes. So we have found everything you can do with unleavened bread that we can imagine. And maybe a few things we haven't tried. And about at day 8, me and the kids feel like buying anything that doesn't crunch. Get out the cake, get out the Twinkies, anything that does not crunch when we bite it. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot shebechol halilot anu ochin shaor yirakot halayla hazeh halayla hazeh maror maror. On all other nights, we can eat all kinds of herbs, but on this night, we eat only bitter herbs. That's our friend horseradish. This is actually considered a vegetable. So if you get your kids to eat parsley, you tricked them into eating vegetables, and they didn't even know it. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot shebechol halilot anu ochlin matpelin afilu pa'am echad. Halayla hazeh, halayla hazeh, shetei fe'amim. On all other nights, we don't even dip once. Not even the potato chips thing. You just don't do it. On this night, we dip twice. The first dipping was the parsley and the salt water. It's already happened. The second dipping is yet to happen. It's an ordered meal. We do things we don't normally do in a specific sequence. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh shebechol halilot anu ochlin bein yoshvein u bein misubin. On all other nights, we eat either sitting or reclining, but on this night we eat reclining. Really, the Passover is done. This is the one time that children are encouraged to slump in their chairs. Okay? Understand that the picture of the Last Supper that was done, the famous picture, it's wrong. They were not in nice marble chairs in the upper room. This is the upper room. You don't want the upper room going into the lower room. It's not a good plan. They would have sat on pillows, reclining back. Now, we know that because John rested on Jesus. With a hardback chair, not a good plan. Why is that such a big deal? In the ancient world, slaves did not recline. They stood at the pleasure of their master and only ate afterward, and there's a whole parable about that. Okay? Or, at best, they sat at attention. To recline means that one is free. And so the children of Israel remember that they now have the freedom to recline at a table. The Maggid is the retelling of the story. If you had an Orthodox grandfather, a conservative Orthodox grandfather like mine, you had not eaten anything except a little parsley and some salt water. Think about how that went. Everything had taken hours to prepare. And so then he would do about 2 hours of the Maggid. We are not doing that this morning. We learned several things. We learned the basic story. We learned to behave ourselves and sit nicely. And we learned we weren't going to eat until we did. I'm going to narrow it down for you. We find out in Exodus 26, verses 5, 10, and 11, that the children of Israel did not go down as a nation. They went down as a ragtag group of tribes of 70 people. It is the slavery in Egypt that is going to mold warring tribes into a solid people. Never underestimate what the crucible can do. It is unpleasant, but sometimes it gets us where we need to be. The king of Egypt, Ramses, now the problem is Ramses was also a dynastic title, so which Ramses? Scholars debate. Died, but Israel still groaned under bondage. So a Pharaoh rose who knew not Joseph and didn't know the blessing that came through the Jewish people. He got nervous. He enslaved them. The next Pharaoh comes up. The children of Israel are in slavery for over 400 years. They cried out, and their cry under bondage came to God. We find that out in Exodus 2:23. And it says in Exodus 2:23 that the Lord heard our voice and looked upon our affliction and remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the reason I do that is, first of all, I need to explain to you, God doesn't have a memory problem. Because we read things like God remembered, and people go, well, does he forget things? It's not a forget like you and I forget. We forget because we have small brains. God doesn't have that problem. Remembering the Hebrew zachor means to bring something to mind deliberately because you're going to act on it. And so when it says God remembered the children of Israel, he brought them to mind because he was going to act upon their situation. When God remembered Noah, he brought Noah's situation to mind because he was ready to step in and complete what he had planned. So understand the word zechor. You're already Hebrew experts after that song earlier by the band, so you can handle another word. What did he remember, that Jewish people were nice people? I joke, I'm in Jewish missions. I have Jewish relatives. You want a list of not nice Jewish people? See me in back. I can help you. Okay. This isn't the point. People get so bugged over things in their Bible about Israel. It has nothing to do with the goodness of the people. What God remembered is that he had made a promise. Theology 101, folks. God acts according to his word and his character. If you understand God's character and you will understand God's word, you will understand what God will do and what God won't do. That's basic theology. Now, every so often I quote the rabbis, because even a broken clock is right twice a day. Okay? The rabbis say that when God appeared in the burning bush, the Jews call that the Shekinah. It's actually one of the great proofs for plurality in the Godhead. He literally dwelt. He had his dwelling presence where he localized himself as the God of the universe. When he appeared in that bush, they say it was a thorn bush. And so the very presence of God wore thorns. Let me read it to you. It's a commentary on Exodus. My people are steeped in sorrow, and in their suffering has pierced my soul like a thorn. Now, what's so cool about that is you've turned to a book written to a bunch of Jewish believers called Hebrews, who are hanging out, and you turn to chapter 1, verse 3. He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his person. And when he had made purification for our sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Reference to Jesus. The radiance of his glory is a reference to the Shekinah, and a Jewish audience would know that. I don't know at the burning bush whether the Shekinah wore a crown of thorns, the glorious dwelling presence of God, but I do know that in the person of Jesus, the Shekinah wore a crown of thorns. Now for the plagues. This is the second cup. It's called the cup of thanksgiving in some traditions. And I like Aaron Lipson's. I borrowed from him his original Passover Haggadah. He was a scholar in Britain and involved in Jewish work. It's also known as the cup of judgment in some other traditions. What I marvel at is that for each of the plagues, a drop of the cup will be taken out. And I marvel because I think of this in terms of the cup of thanksgiving, and the thanksgiving is lessened because the Egyptians had to suffer. And I can back that up with some neat lines from the rabbis about not rejoicing over the suffering of others. And so, I'm going to take a drop out for each of the plagues. This is the only time kids get to play with their food is Passover. Okay. Dam is blood, frogs, gnats, avrov, flies, dever shechin, pestilence, shechin, boils, balad, hail, arba, locusts, koshech, darkness, mekat habachrot, slaying of the firstborn. Okay? Understand that the plagues are not random. Each of these plagues is against a particular Egyptian deity. The reason that is so important is God is not only doing something for the Israelites, he's reaching out to the Egyptians. God's mercy and his judgment are not separate. I always like to point out that God's wrath is the flip side of his love. And here's the way I think of it. If I love my wife and someone attacks her, what's my emotion going to be? Wrath at the attacker. So my love moves me to wrath. Now, how does that work with sin? God loves his creation. God loves the image of himself that he has placed in each person. His reaction of wrath is against the destruction of his image in each person and against his universe being contaminated. In other words, God don't like garbage in his neighborhood. And sin is the garbage that we allow to infest his neighborhood. So God's love for his image and us as image bearers moves him to wrath when we destroy the image of himself that he has placed in us as image bearers. This cup would then be drank. Now, what you should notice is how many cups are left. Two. So we're moving along. This is probably the last cup that Jesus drank. I know he stopped because he says, he took the cup and gave thanks. Take this and divide this among yourselves, for I say, will not drink of the fruit of the vine again until the kingdom of God shall come. So at some point, he stopped drinking. My best estimate in trying to harmonize the Gospels, it's probably this cup because of the significance of the next two cups. There's a second washing because I'm going to be touching items. I'm not going to do that, but I am going to talk to you about the items I'm going to touch. This is horseradish, and it looks like it's like almost fresh ground horseradish. It looks real horseradishy. We need to understand something very important as Americans. We live in a free country. But we forget that there are two types of slavery. There's the slavery from without and the slavery from within. Now, Jesus does discuss this. He says, whoever sins is a slave to it. So there's a different type of slavery. This horseradish represents the bitterness of slavery. But if you are physically free and an American, but you have not gotten yourself free from master sin, you are a slave still. Do not leave here without seeing somebody because you need the freedom of the ultimate lamb. Now, right about now, you'd think I'm going to go ahead and just eat straight horseradish. I like horseradish, but you don't have to do that. How many of you have gone out to the local grocery store right around Easter to get a thing of sop? Because he dipped the bread into the sop, right? So there must be grade A sop and grade B sop and grade C sop at your grocery store. No, I'm going to tell you where the sop came from. Two rabbis prior to Jesus had an argument over which three things had to be eaten together during a Passover Seder. Shammai and Hillel. The old joke is three Jews, four opinions. And so what you had was by the time Jesus enters, these rabbinical schools with their disciples already existed. And so you had an argument. The guy who won the argument was Hillel. So this is called the Hillel sandwich. And so Hillel wins. He gets the sandwich. It's also called the korech. Now I'm going to borrow a little matzah just to demonstrate this. The FDA no longer allows the dipping in a common bowl. Do not try this at church. But in the ancient world, you had the sop, which was the elements that had to be taken together. Hillel said the matzah has to be taken together, the bitter herbs and the haroset have to be eaten together. They probably threw some of the lamb in too. Dip in, get some of the sop on the thing, Hillel sandwich. We go ahead and break it into an actual sandwich now with the top and bottom. You put some of the haroset, some of the horseradish. You're supposed to put enough horseradish to bring tears to your eyes. For some people, that's like one grain. Okay? The haroset actually makes the horseradish burn less, and you have a Hillel sandwich. Now, let me tell you what's kind of interesting about this. This is right before the meal. Okay? Jesus passes the sop. We find out in John 13 that Jesus said one will betray him, and everybody's looking at each other going, not me, not, you know, maybe him. I don't know. He's been acting strange lately. Who knows? And you had this thing going on, and Jesus says, no, it's the one to whom I give the sop when I dip it. And he dipped the sop, and he gave it to Judas Iscariot, son of Simon. And after the sop, Satan entered into him, and Jesus said unto him, what thou doest, do quickly, in the King James. First of all, I think it's a last outreach to Judas, because a rabbi generally gave the sop as an act of kindness. That says nothing about Judas, because Judas does what Judas does anyway. It says a lot about Jesus. And I think that's significant. The other thing, too, is that Judas is not, Iscariot's not a last name. I used to think it was like last names and first names. Iscariot comes from two Hebrew words. Ish means man. Karoth was a suburb of Jerusalem. Judas from the suburb of Jerusalem. Why is that significant? He's the only disciple not from the Galilee area. All the other disciples were around from Jesus' hometown. Judas is the only disciple from the religious center of Israel who was not from the area that Jesus had originally ministered in. So that's a little, he was kind of the outsider. He was also a bit of a crook, which also comes out. So you make the sandwich, and you eat the sandwich, and that's probably the first real thing you've had other than parsley, and it's right before the meal. Now, because I'm doing this as a demonstration, this is not going to be my mealtime. Okay? What this is going to be is a little break time. You receive these. Okay? Now, the first thing you need to know is that after 120 years of being a mission board, Chosen People Ministries has discovered perforation, probably the greatest advance in missions work that has been discovered. And so you have these. This is my lovely family. I have one son who's now married with a wife. She doesn't appear. We have new pictures we want to put on here. And then I have a daughter here who is as far away as mom and dad could let her get and still remain on the planet. No, I'm just teasing a little. Argentina. And she's learning Spanish the hard way. And so you are going to get my testimony. Okay? Cute barcode. And this is the company attendance slip. I could have said I was here and maybe gone up to Prescott and just partied all morning and visited the shops, but I didn't do that because I want to be with you. And I love doing this and I love ministering. But how do they know I came? Well, they know because you filled this out and you give it back to me. And they go, wow, he either wrote out a dozen of these in different handwriting, which means he's a great forger, or he was actually at this church. So you're going to fill those out. You are not to walk out the door with them. I tell people, if you stick this in your pocket, you will have blue pockets for the rest of your life. Don't do it. Please make sure they get back to me. If someone could collect those afterwards, I don't make you pay postage. I turn them all in with the paperwork. And so if you'll be filling that out right now. Now, what you don't want is radio silence, right? So while you're filling those out, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to give you how a nice Jewish boy ends up in a church in Prescott doing Passover Seders, and then I will actually open the floor for a question or two, and I'll try to repeat your question. And you're going to be filling those out. I only need one per family because we know that the husband and wife have become one flesh, so that's really two slips. Okay? And the kids, they usually turn into paper airplanes, and we're not going to do that in the sanctuary, so we'll avoid that. You have the basic story there. I didn't set out. My grandfather was Orthodox conservative. He was practicing. My dad was an agnostic, virtually an atheist. I think now he has crossed the border into theism at 80-some-odd years old, but that's about as far as he's gotten. He now occasionally attends a Reconstructionist synagogue. That's a synagogue that has so little theological content that it's sort of like water with like less than a chicken bouillon cube in it. It's a rather interesting form of Judaism. It's a lot of culture and customs, but no connection to what they sort of mean. And sort of postmodern Judaism. It all depends on what the word is. That sort of thing. Him and my grandfather used to argue about the existence of God. Not necessarily in the most logical terms. I had a strong, I don't know how to put it, interest in God. I believed that there definitely was a God. I did not side with my father. I was very zealous for the traditions of my forefathers. My grandfather on my mom's side was sort of like my spiritual mentor. He took me to synagogue. He made sure I went to Jewish summer camp. And he roomed with me for a little while when my grandmother died. And so I'd go with him to synagogue. And so he sort of became a mentor to me. And so I like to say that my dad honed my apologetic skills by arguing with me, and my grandfather introduced me to my heritage and its theological content. When I got to high school, there were not a lot of nice Jewish girls around, and so I started dating a Catholic girl. That's a violation of the 11th Jewish commandment, thou shalt not date Catholics. And so that did not go over really big. The standard line is, if a fish marries a bird, where will they live? And so my grandparents reacted to that very strongly, and so I reacted to their prejudice. And I cooled in my practice of Judaism. and began to study the sciences. I'm the kid at high school age that wanted to build a laser. My science teacher said, what? I said, a laser. He said, do you know what that means? And I quoted it exactly. I was also very into philosophy. I was interested in theology. There's one character in Jewish history called Moses Maimonides that I sort of liked. He was a doctor, a philosopher, and a Jewish theologian and thinker. And he was kind of interesting to me. And so I cooled in things, and I looked at the sciences. You know what I didn't find any more out about? God. Everything I could learn from the sciences didn't tell me any more about God than Judaism did. I went to college the first year, and I had a cantankerous roommate who said, I dare you to go to a navigator study on the Gospel of John. And I was, like, fascinated by theology and philosophy. It's like, well, I'd like to hear, you know, I think these guys are totally wrong, but, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, what they're doing. And you know what I got hit with was the Trinity. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. He was with God in the beginning. And I'm going through this, and I'm going, oh, wait a minute. Could you please help me? Christians are monotheists, Jews are monotheists. Run me through this. Go through the persons of God. God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit. How many fingers do you have up? Yeah, that's what I thought too. Right. I said, well, how do you guys do math? Do you know what God did? He took me starting with the Old Testament. And when I was growing up, Deuteronomy 6:4 through 6:9, which is very precious to Jews, they recite it three times a day, became like a personal oath of fealty because I learned that God was the good king. And that's the way I understood God. He was the good king. And I really related to that image. And where there's a king, there ought to be an oath of fealty. The Shema is the oath of fealty. And so now God starts with Deuteronomy 6:4 and shows me every evidence for plurality in the Godhead from Deuteronomy clear through the Hebrew Scriptures. And then I go back home. Before I did, I went to a navigator. You want to convict a young man, bring him to a Navigator's Purity of Life seminar. Because I was a good kid. My parents said, trouble found me, I didn't find it. Okay? I was what you call a schlamazel. A schlemiel is a guy who spills his soup. A schlamazel is the guy he spills it on. And I was a bit of a schlamazel. And they said, you're basically a good kid. But I had a girlfriend. And I didn't quite keep boundaries perfectly. And so I went to this Purity of Life seminar. And I thought, you know I do some wrong. I had guilt down. Jewish people do. But for Jewish people, sin is not a condition of the heart as much as it's a violation of the command. Sin is an action. There's no such thing as sin nature in Judaism. Not like you understand sin nature. There's an evil inclination, but they also think there's a good inclination. They don't understand depravity. Okay? Not like you and I do. And so I came face to face with the fact that I had violated my standards. If I violated my standards and God's the king, his standards have to be higher than mine. And then I found the gospel according to Moses. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Where's the blood? And from there, I started studying the messianic prophecies, and I discovered that Jesus was not Swedish, and he was not Italian, and he fulfilled the prophecies. So that's kind of a condensed version. You have a real condensed version on the back. To remember to turn those in, because that's a perfect segue into the bread and cup, which I now understand in a totally different way. Now remember, I'm an unsaved Jewish kid who doesn't believe in the Trinity, that's just had the second of the three that is one, that's bruised and pierced and broken, buried, and ask the rabbis why there are three matzahs and why you break the middle one, and you get the silliest explanations, and none of them work. They'll say, that represents the third division of the tribes or some weird thing like that. Forget it. There's no evidence of that. Now, the second of the three that is one, which is bruised and pierced, is redeemed. When you're a Jewish kid, this is hidden, and you're in a race against your female cousins to find it. This is called the afikomen. It means dessert. You've had the meal. What do you eat after the meal? Dessert. But it also comes from a Greek word, aphikomai, or might, which means I will come. And so that's kind of an interesting thing, a little double meaning there. Jesus takes this out. This is the bread and the bread of cup and the cup. Because he takes the cup and the bread from the meal, which means they had ate in Luke. He's taking it from the meal's been eaten. He's taking it from the things that remain after the meal. Oh, the buried piece. And he ends up using this. Now, before we deal with the bread and cup by going further, you now have to ask which cup. This is the cup of redemption. The promise is, I will redeem you. Did the disciples get it? No, they didn't get it. Peter's pulling out a sword and removing ears. I mean, these guys didn't get it. We'll talk more about why they didn't get it. But the reality is, Jesus is trying to get a message to them. He's going to be arrested. They're expecting a king. You're going to march into Jerusalem. You're going to take over. You're going to kick the Romans out. You're going to set up the kingdom of God on earth. End of story. End of oppression. The promises come. All over. No problems for us. Life is beautiful. It's not going to happen. And they're going to be totally problemed, stressed, bothered, confused. In fact, he tries to tell them about their death, and they just can't put it together. So what does he do? He takes the cup of redemption. The minute he picks this cup up, the promise, I will redeem you, is echoing in their brains. So let's put the sentences together. I will redeem you. This is the blood of the new covenant, the Brit Hadasha, which was shed. Do this in remembrance of me. This represents the blood of the new covenant. I will redeem you. My death will redeem you. Here's the symbolic of my death. Here's the inauguration of the new covenant. The new covenant is being inaugurated. Remember, Judas can't be part of the new covenant. He split. He disfellowed himself from the covenant meal, and he disfellowed himself from the covenant cup by doing so. He has excluded himself and chosen the path of resisting God's grace. He's trying to connect his death, which is coming, with the inauguration of the new covenant being fully inaugurated, or I should say being inaugurated, for these guys that still don't get it. Third cup. This is my body, bruised and pierced, gentlemen. You've been eating this all night. The aphikomen represents the Paschal lamb too. It's the third of the sacrificial symbols. Broken for you. It was the second of the three that was won, that's bruised, that pierced, that was buried, that was resurrected. Whoa. That he points to. The gospel has just been played out at a Jewish table every year. Ah, but you see, when Moses is read, there's a veil over their eyes, and in Jesus, the veil is lifted, and the connections are made. And now, instead of seeing a book of Gentiles and my book, I now see one story bound together and see all the connections and rejoice to teach them. The book has been made one. How exciting. Well, we do have to deal with another thing, okay? We have to deal with the fact that there's still a cup here. Remember, there's one more promise. I will take you to me for a people. And then there's a cup that nobody drinks. This is Elijah's cup. When I do this as a meal, I sing the little song inviting Elijah. I'm going to spare you my singing voice this morning and let you know that Elijah won't show up. Why did they expect Elijah? When prophecy is being given, the prophets are not giving chronological order. They're giving major events. Think of it as a newspaper with headlines, without the details. So they read in Malachi that God was going to send a forerunner, Malachi 3:1. And then they read in Malachi 4, "Behold, I send you Elijah." And they said, "Aha, Malachi 3:3 And Malachi 4 must be discussing the same thing, not knowing there were thousands of years. Prophecy is epotelesmatic. That's a fancy Greek word for you're looking at mountaintops, but you can't see the valleys in between. And that's the way prophecy works. The prophets didn't want a chronological order. They wanted to tell you what the next headline would read like. And so the Jewish people expect Elijah to come, but they expected Elijah to come at Messiah's first coming. And Jewish people will say, well, there's no second coming in the Bible. And I'll say, yes, there is. Because Micah tells me he'll be born in Bethlehem, and Daniel tells me he will return in the clouds. You either have two Messiahs or you have two comings. Show me where Messiah is plural in the Old Testament. It's singular because there's one. Therefore, there must be two comings of one Messiah. Let me give you a take-home for you guys. Remember I told you this is the fourth cup? This is the cup I will take you to me for a people. Do you know that the word lekach in Hebrew can have the normal word for to take or to seize, or it can have covenantal meaning, like Isaac took Rebecca. Doesn't mean to the movies. Means for a wife. When I think about this cup, I think about the fact that God has made a covenant with me. Marriage is a great and the ultimate picture of covenant. Here's the thought. When you sin, you step out on God. The same way a spouse steps out on their spouse. Sin is spiritual adultery. Now you understand its gravity. Something to consider when tempted. The Seder ends with Jewish people telling God that they did everything. I always get a kick out of that. We not only have to do it, we have to tell God we did it. And so there's something very messianic. Jesus talks about the vine and the vine branches. That is deep Old Testament symbolism. Israel is compared to a vineyard in the Song of the Vineyard in Isaiah. So we end up talking to God and saying, O pure one enthroned above, rise up the low, free the captives, bring the kingdom, in other words, replant on Zion in love thy vine branch nigh to thee. My Father is the vine dresser. I am the vine. You are the branches. Abide in me, and you'll bear much fruit, and you will. Well, that's all I have. I need those things collected. I hope that the story has become one story for you in a new way this morning.